Nikolai Dyanortchik had lured enough enemies into traps over his years of service for the GRU to know when a pit was being dug. It was something in the way the other man moved, a tightness about the shoulders, for example, a sheen of sweat brought on from a racing pulse, the fear and paranoia he might be found out causing him to move a little more quickly than normal. Eye contact was another giveaway, the opponent laying the ambush unable to look directly into his eyes. Colonel Kalinko displayed all those symptoms. But did he not have his own scheme in the works? Perhaps that was why Kalinko was acting so strangely. Perhaps Kalinko knew, had sounded the alarm to those of authority beyond the main intelligence directorate. If that was true, then there was much to fear. Kalinko should find no great concern in the fact that he and his GRU comrades were smuggling ordnance, including chemical and biological agents, out of the compound to sell to Iranian militants. The deal had already been approved by his superiors in the GRU. Kalinko was not aware of the details because his service record, complete with psychological profile, indicated the colonel would never accept such intrigue, tainted with the appearance of probable treason. The business transaction with the Iranians was a matter of national security. A rearmed Iran, flush with WMD, was necessary to preserve their own crumbling, volatile borders. Plus, Moscow didn't want to see another Islamic nation fall to the Americans. Should America occupy another oil-rich Muslim nation, there was no telling how far and wide they would attempt to extend their power by military force. Who would be the next to get stomped under the boot heel of American imperialist colonialism? Uzbekistan? Chechnya? Tajikistan? They were having trouble enough as it stood with the breakaway so-called satellite states. Why should his country fear American occupation on its very border? No, not on his watch. Admittedly, he and his colleagues were turning more money in one deal than they would see in a lifetime of service to their country. But after 20 loyal years of risking his life, he figured the country owed him a bit more than the bleak prospect of wasting away in a drab apartment in Moscow when he retired. AK-74 in hand, he led his four-man team into the command and control center. He discovered only two operators at the banks of monitors. He read the fear in their expressions as he marched toward them.
Where are the others? There should be at least 8 men in here at all times.
The two operators shrugged their shoulders, neither looking him directly in the eyes. Dyanortchik flew down the banks of monitors, inspecting every square yard of the facility displayed to him. Spacesuits down in level 4, working with their centrifuges and vials, fiddling with dials on various panels or sitting at their computers, normal routine. The perimeter in front of the compound, north to south, looked quiet enough, sentries at post in the towers. He focused next on Hangar 2, where they were building another lightning bat, engineers spread down the spars, tools in hand, lab coats and bays working on computer graphics. He was about to demand where Colonel Kalinko was when he spotted him on the last monitor.
Why is he in the main hangar?
The colonel was waving off the sentries posted around the hangar as he clearly moved with purpose for the main door, AK-74 in hand. Dyanortchik was looking toward the arrow-shaped fighter jet when he spotted the pilot in full jumpsuit and helmet heading straight for Lightning Bat. And why were the ramp ladders in place, allowing him a quick climb into the cockpit? There was no test flight scheduled. A moment later, and another figure in jumpsuit and helmet emerged, but coming from the wrong direction, the quarters of all the flight crews located elsewhere. Kalinko moved to the hangar doors and began punching in a code on the keypad. The doors began to open.
They're stealing Lightning Bat.
He whirled on the two young operators.
What are they doing? Talk or die.
Sir, it's the colonel's orders. We were ordered to let in a team from Z entrance, but we know nothing else.
You're lying. You sat here all along and allowed intruders into this compound to steal a prototype aircraft that belongs to our country. That amounts to no less than treason. But I will save the state the cost of executing you.
Jack Grimaldi thought he could hear the war drum of his heart pounding inside his helmet. With all the specs he'd pored over, committing to memory all vital displays and control systems, Lightning Bat should be no problem to handle, provided, of course, the 6 of them weren't being corralled for slaughter. The list of everything that added up wrong shot like lightning bolts through his head. 1. Going in blind. 2. Teaming up with a Russian pilot dumped on Grimaldi at the last minute by the company. 3. Unknown Russian operatives allegedly paving the road in and out. 4. Lightning Bat supposedly given a thorough pre-flight rundown by his Russian counterpart. 5. The 4 points missiles theoretically already loaded in the weapons bay. 6. Hangar doors and front gate opened by an inside man. 7. A runway promised just beyond the front gate, a 5,000-yard stretch of hard-packed earth. Was it insane to believe all this was legitimate? Then let the madness begin, Grimaldi decided as he marched out into open ground. He spotted his counterpart moving swiftly to starboard. The Russian threw him a thumbs up, left hand, Grimaldi matching the code sign but with his right thumb in the air. There was a wide metallic walkway directly above, suspended on poles, not wire like the standard catwalk. He heard boots drumming up there. He closed on the tail of the big bird they would commandeer out. The hangar doors started opening. His gut warned him that this was far too easy. Bah, to hell with it. Up, up, and away. Visor down, but the M16 held low by his side, just in case the Russian pilot was a human adder, the duffel bag with a sat-link in the other hand. Grimaldi heard his breath echo through his helmet as he fell in behind Lightning Bat's port. He was hidden from the view of sentries up on the catwalks to the north, west, and east. His potential snipers spread around the massive hangar, but he kept waiting for the hammer to drop. The pilot bounded up the ramp, beating him to the cockpit.
Stop! Stop or we shoot!
Jack Grimaldi had no inclination to stop. McCarter judged it was all going to hell fast in the hangar as he heard the autofire breaking out from various undetermined points beyond the doors. The joint American-Russian operatives had supplied them with blueprints to what they were told was their target area. It was mentally mapped. But McCarter had to wonder just how raw and bloody it could all get if the fighting spilled into the other areas of the complex. Hawkins and James peeled off for a narrow corridor that paralleled the length of the hangar. Shooters were clearly already out in open territory, and it would be their bloody task to hit them blindside. The CIA FSK detachment was splitting off for a hallway to McCarter's Deep Six, gone to do their spook duties. Part of their job was to secure the anti-aircraft batteries that, assuming Grimaldi and his Russian flyboy counterpart rolled out of the gate, could blow them to smithereens before they were wheels up. McCarter led Mannequin and Caesar through the double metal doors, shouldering his way, all bull, all adrenaline. The passageway was a 20-foot charge. Then the ex-SAS commando hit the corner, took in the uniformed guards on the catwalk downrange. Several of them were frozen up top, uncertain who or what to shoot, as a black suit with an AK-74 led a squad away from the chopper pool to the deep north end. Grimaldi was taking fire halfway up his ramp, the ace pilot sweeping his M16 back and forth at the enemy troops above.
Right!
McCarter pointed at the walkway directly ahead. Enciso flying past, the multi-round projectile launcher filling his hands, McCarter wheeled around the corner, Manning on his right wing. Then both Phoenix Force commandos unleashed their M16s on the enemy pack headed for Lightning Bat. Grimaldi nailed two soldiers up top with his opening M16 burst. The chest fronts of the uniforms chewed to red tatters by the 5.56mm Blizzard as they pitched back out of sight. That left 4 more AK-74s. The stragglers now charging down the walkway, drawing beads with their assault rifles. 2, maybe 3 lines of auto fire cutting loose. Sparks blazing off the ramp, Grimaldi saw rounds drum over Lightning Bat's hull. His Russian co-pilot had made it inside the cockpit and was manning the controls. Grimaldi saw Enciso breaking out into the open below, the multi-round projectile launcher spitting smoke and flame to bring down the ceiling on the 4 shooters. Jacked on adrenaline, Grimaldi felt as if he was being lifted on divine wings as he flew up the rest of the ramp, the thunder of the explosions above slamming shockwaves into his backside. The clamshell canopy dropping, he jumped down into his seat and felt the fighter jet lurch ahead, wrenching away from its ramps as he dumped his weapon and bag on the narrow space between pilot and co-pilot chair. Strapping himself in, he was ready to rumble, grab the sidearm controller, when he noticed the display and control panels were all lit up in red.
Shit, what's wrong? We're so far into the danger zone that...
Hello, I am Yuri.
Grimaldi looked at the handsome face inside the helmet as the fighter jet gathered speed.
Why is our instrument panel in the red?
No worry, everything normal.
Bullshit! Red tells me we're in the crapper!
No, no. Red, yes. Good. Remember, it is Russian jet.
Yuri Kalinko knew he wouldn't make it through the night, but he was determined he would reach the gate, even if he was shot down and forced to drag himself the rest of the distance, trailing blood and guts. If he was going to die, then it wouldn't be in vain. At the very least, he would defeat the GRU traitors by freeing Lightning Bat from their clutches. The battle was raging to another crescendo of weapons fire, it seemed, as he plucked his handheld radio off his belt. There were dark shadows up in the three towers, immobilized by the uncertainty of the moment, but he had to try to reach them before they opened fire. Running hard, he was on the verge of patching through when the first heavy machine gun began thundering from the closest tower. Yanorchik had alerted the sentries. A fresh clip fed to his AK-74. He held back on the trigger, sprinting on, closing, 50 feet or so, as he blasted out the window behind the sentry. The heavy machine gun fell silent as the guard vanished. He was beyond any decent field of fire from the other two towers now. 20 feet to the gate. 10. The heavy machine gun round tore into Kalinko's thigh. He was spinning, falling, but somehow he managed the strength to return fire. The earth ground up around him in a series of divots. He thought he glimpsed the sentry jerk, the flaming nose of the big gun swinging for the dark Tajik sky. He collapsed beside the gate, the world spinning, the light fading from his eyes. He knew he was hit bad, bleeding out quick, shock about to paralyze him. He shimmied up on his good leg, threw his hand against the wall, bracing himself, willed his fingers to work. He tapped in the first two numbers. Rafik Namak couldn't sleep. The infidel situation was troublesome enough, and he had been in council with eight of his top lieutenants at length. Questions rife with concern and laced with worries over the sincerity of the American commandos had taken up the better part of an hour. Did they do business with these Americans after the failure of the first group? Could the Americans get their hands on more of this splat ordnance, even a tactical nuke? Were they telling the truth, or simply stringing him along for money to spare their lives? That they didn't trust the Americans went without saying, and he sensed several of his lieutenants would just as soon execute the infidels and attempt to purchase another shipment. Already there had been two major attacks, one on his village near the border and the aerial bombardment on Al-Sadiq. They had decimated his forces, and now he was without air support. And then there was the dream. 3 nights now, the dream had invaded his mind just as he'd fallen asleep. It was so lifelike he was left shaken, drenched in cold sweat when he'd come lurching, gasping to a breathless awakening. In the dream, no, nightmare, he had seen giant vultures dropping missiles and guided bombs from their talons. He had seen the camp go up in flames, his holy fighters shrieking human torches thrashing over the ground. He had stood, the Grand Ayatollah on the mountain, watching the horror in front of him, frozen in place before hitting his knees, crying out to Allah, demanding, "Why?" And then the armed shadows came for him. They wielded axes and swords. As they moved near, he saw they weren't human. Rather, they had the faces of demons, red eyes burning with rage, fangs dripping blood, their flesh covered in oozing sores with maggots spewing from their mouths. He would fire upon them, but the bullets seemed to core right through them, as if their flesh were made of water. Then, as they descended upon him, these silent demons, who then appeared more animal than human, hacking away at his hands, his feet, he shuddered, willing the image to vanish from his mind's eye. It was time to take action. He would see the night through, sleep or not, and in the morning there would be a massive call to arms. It was time to ship out the great jihad, one wave of suicide bombers with the WMD vests after another. Iraq, Israel, it was time to scorch the earth. If the infidels chose not to give him the access codes, then he knew drastic measures would be necessary. He didn't think they would capitulate under torture, but if he took his sword to one of them, it was worth a try. Surely in all the land he could find, purchase the services of a computer hack.
Your Holiness.
Namak keyed his handheld radio.
Yes?
The Americans refused to give us the access codes.
They wanted money, which he intended not to give them. Yes, he would promise them payments once they handed over the access codes, but then, or perhaps not, say they could land him more ordnance. If so, they would have to prove that they could before they received another payment. He took his field glasses, switched them to infrared. He found the group in question about 50 yards north of the two Russian transport trucks. The cannon had been put together, erected near the pod with its four Eagle Nebula cruise missiles, the UAV on the ground beside the launch rail. Decision time.
Tell them to take the night and sleep on their decision. Then bring them up here to me before the sun rises.
It will be done, Your Holiness.
Namek searched the length of the camp on all points, then looked up at the dark, moonlit sky. He decided to pray, if for nothing else, that God would grant him a night's sleep, free of the terrifying vision of his gruesome death. McCarter shot from the hip as he charted his fighting course for the hangar door, hanging one, then two Russian hard men charging from the chopper pool. They all knew the towers housed heavy machine guns, and right then he was more worried about Lightning Bat getting blasted off the ground than the fighting course downrange, which Hawkins and James appeared to have under bloody control. The Briton saw Hawkins and James hitting the enemy backside with a blizzard of rounds, hard men and those red lightning commandos giving up the ghost as they spun and toppled like dominoes. The catwalk shooters were in the process of taking hits from Manning, swan diving to concrete, crash landing with a sickening crack of broken bones as wild return rounds came screaming their way, whining off the hangar floor. Aware of the consequences of ultimate mission failure, McCarter found Enciso taking the lead as he burst onto open ground beyond the hangar doors. Something was wrong near the gate, McCarter saw. A figure struggling to stay on its feet, hand punching at the keypad. He assumed he was their contact. He was lining up one of the three towers, but Enciso beat him to it, chugging away two hell bombs. The explosions lit up the night, silencing the guns. Lightning Bat taxied out of the hangar. McCarter willed the gate to open as the fighter jet appeared to halt. Then the figure at the gate collapsed.
Son of a bitch!
He ran, ready to pulverize the gate when it began to part. Grimaldi gave the bird ignition. The XSAS commando briefly admired the ace pilot's brazen style, the fighter jet streaking away, wings clearing the gate with 2 or 3 feet to spare. Scouting the open ground around him, withering fire hitting his backside from the hangar, and McCarter was grateful when no cavalry charged into the night. He saw Lightning Bat shrink as Grimaldi and his Russian co-pilot hit full throttle, tearing down the runway, lifting, next rising, then shooting for the sky, swallowed within seconds by thick, low cloud cover. Mission accomplished. Now, he thought, all they had to do was find out if their CIA counterparts would live up to their promise of trucking them to a waiting Gulfstream. A curtain call was due before dawn. He checked his watch. Factor in travel time back to base in Iraq, and if their air armada was refueling and re-upping the hardware as Brognola and Price had informed him they would, hardly the home stretch. But it was getting better by the minute. Every enemy they dropped from here on would make the world a little kinder, gentler place. McCarter keyed his handheld radio to contact the CIA.
The bird has flown. Now, how about that ride out of here you promised?
Brognola saw Price give him the thumbs up as she walked away from the sat link.
Jack's clear of Tajik airspace. They came under fire on the way out, but he says he doesn't think anything was damaged. He'll know more when he gets back to our Iraq base and can give Lightning Bat a thorough check. His Russian co-pilot went over all the systems with him.
Let me guess. He aced the test.
He says it's actually no more difficult than your standard F-117. There's no nuclear reactor and no divine alloy to worry about with this version, which I suppose under the circumstances is a plus.
I'll take all the pluses I can get right now.
David called. Phoenix is on the way out, pretty much in Jack's exhaust.
Which means they could still hit Namek before dawn.
We'll use the same air firepower support as before.
For once, something is going right. For once, someone has played it straight with us. Oh, Hunt and Carmen think that Namek may be sitting on some special ordnance in camp.
Those Russian transports you mentioned?
Yeah. I don't want our guys setting foot in that camp. I never liked the idea of our troops running around in hazmat suits anyway. Too damn cumbersome and confining, you ask me. So let the place get burned down from above. Whoever scurries out of there, we'll get another day.
And Namek is still perched on his roost in the mountain?
About 300 or so feet up, facing toward his Army of Armageddon, which I hope will soon be the Army of the Damned.
So you want Phoenix to take Namek and whatever lieutenants he has with him on the mountain?
That's the plan. Get all pertinent imagery facts to David. I need to go have a quick talk with our aerospace superstar.
Spagnola walked up to where Jacobs and Kurtzman were going over the grip map of Namek's camp.
How's it going, Bear? Ask the good doctor.
After all your insistence that I would prove so critical to getting your man in the air, you had the Russian pilot with him all along.
It was last minute, and we still need you to calibrate those missiles for my man.
Should be simple enough. It'll be a fairly straight drop, and you'll have to calibrate the missiles with the degree bearings. I'm working on it now. You said he'll be strafing from 5,000 feet?
Yes.
400 knots?
Right.
The calibration will have to coincide with a delay shutdown valve for the missile rocket fuel. That way, they'll drop at the degrees I will give him. Hit and skim. He'll have to rotate the spindle according to the bearings I send on.
Don't let me stop you. Get it done. You have 15 minutes.
Slave driver, aren't we?
Spagnola ignored Jacobs and walked away for a moment of silence. None of them were in the clear yet, but the big Fed was beginning to see daylight. Whatever mess, political or otherwise, lay ahead, he'd deal with the fallout when the time came. This was his show. And this was one war Phoenix Force and Grimaldi were meant to take to the finish line. Avalon knew it was over. The Iranians wanted the codes, and he didn't need to hear the or else to know they were about to kill the three of them. He found the Grand Ayatollah sitting Indian style on the ledge, an odd smile on his lips as he stared at the sprawling mass of his camp. They were getting ready for something down there, Avalon surmised. Armed jihadists piling into vehicles, about 200 or so in the heart of the camp, truck engines grinding to life. Heading out, he believed, for Iraq, ready to kill a bunch of innocent people. And he was sure Namek was about to put the ultimatum to him. Avalon decided to play it cool, lighting up a cigarette. He took in the setup, having already told Cheevers and Solstice to be braced to go for broke, throats, eyes, nuts, whatever it was necessary to take one down and grab a weapon, start spraying, but spare Namek if possible. 10 militants, though, would prove a tough match, unless he got his hands on an AK with his first strike. There was one Iranian just to his left, eyes boring into him, assault rifle aimed off his body. If he couldn't get money, then he could at least survive, figure out his next move once he was back in Iraq. He still had a few contacts in the company, men who had fought beside him, proved loyal, were perhaps of like mind when it came to turning a buck. Avalon checked the sky, a dirty gray smudge, the dawn of a new day less than an hour off. A new day, but with very little promise.
Don't you worry about an air attack?
If it were going to happen, it would have already happened.
Avalon wondered why his nerves were getting torqued up the longer he watched the skies.
You will give us the access codes.
What about our money?
The men who you claim were killed in the village were already paid for this shipment.
It's no claim. Their history. Money or no codes. And that UAV stays grounded without them.
I see.
I don't think you do.
Avalon pitched away his cigarette. He thought he heard a faint buzzing to the south and started to search the horizon in that direction. The first line of thundering explosions tore through the heart of the camp, jolting Avalon with cold fear. Now he knew it was over. Those were cluster bombs, as he watched one wave of brilliant flashes after another marching in lines, all points of the compass, massive explosions erasing any object in their paths. The transports with their gruesome payloads were ignited, flung into the air, as more blasts sheared them apart, stick figures skyrocketing from wreckage winging out in all directions. A quick look skyward, and he made out the batwing shape of a stealth, several thousand feet up and soaring over the mountain. And in the distant west, he spotted the airstrike coming in to mop up whatever was left down there, fleeing for its life. Fighter jets, and what he believed was the girth of a specter coming in low and hard, dropping the hammer. Avalon wheeled on the closest Iranian, clawed his hand into his throat and squeezed. The Iranian began dancing, holding back on the trigger of his assault rifle, Avalon glimpsing two, then three of his fellow extremists absorbing rounds, tumbling as the autofire blazed on. Avalon ripped his throat out, flung the bloody flesh away as he plucked the AK from limp hands.
Where's Namek?
Turning, Avalon saw the Iranian running down a gully, a few lieutenants on his heels. Cheevers was bent over Solstice, checking for a pulse.
Come on, Cheevers, let's go get our man with the money. Forget Solstice, he's gone. Our money, though, is running away.
McCarter wanted a DNA sample from the Terra Lord of the Year. No double, no ringer was going to muck up the mission now that he sensed they were snapping the jaws of death shut. He led the hop off the Black Hawk, M16 M203 filling his hands for the finishing touches, his Apache gunship swinging out to the north, gone to search for enemy blood. No hellfires, no extended chain gun barrage unless he gave the order. He didn't need to spend 2 days scooping up blood and gristle and guts just for some CIA guy back in Iraq to tell him it wasn't Namek. There were five of them, he spotted, heading right in their direction, heading blind and straight into their guns. According to the farm sat stake, the black turban belonged to Namek. He hand-signaled his troops to grab a fire point 20 yards or so where the armed group would run right into them. They appeared more concerned about the Apache as they began spraying auto-fire at the warbird. But it was like shooting spitballs at the gunship's armored skin. McCarter hit a crouch behind a boulder, drew a bead with his M16, waiting as they came around a bend in the gully.
Fire at will!
Phoenix Force cut loose in unison. Holding back on his trigger, McCarter hit who he believed was Namek with a long burst of M16 auto-fire, rounds chewing up his chest as the mullah who would be Shiite king of the Middle East flailed, his AK stuttering impotent rounds at the sky.
Hey, you up there! Look to me! I got a proposition!
McCarter climbed for higher ground, leading his men to a promontory, homing in on the direction of the voice.
Aaron, this is Apache. You got two hostiles, Tiger Stripes, about 20 feet below you. Shall we take them out?
No, I'll handle it.
McCarter couldn't wait to hear the man's deal. He saw them, two heads and shoulders above a ring of boulders.
You! There's money in this to get us out of here. Millions if you get me in touch with my people back in the States. I know a classified base. They make all kinds of high-tech merchandise. If we work together with my people in the States, you'll be a rich man. There's plenty of Navaks in these parts. Won't be any problem unloading the stuff.
Throw down your weapon. It's over.
Kiss my ass. It's never over.
Rafe, finish him off.
And Cizo unslung the multi-round projectile launcher and began chugging away the final answer. And Cizo's reply was more than enough to blow the two traitors off the mountain.
Congratulations are in order, my Justice Department friend. I should have brought champagne, but you strike me more as a whiskey man, not some wine-bibbing sissified frog or yuppie teetotaler we have swarming all over this fair city of ours. Look at yourself. If I could hug you, I would. You are the man. You took on Iran, declared a war, albeit covert, all on your own pair. No White House, no Congress. Barely a peep from that part of the world, not even a soundbite from Al Jazeera. And there you sit. King Kong, Godzilla, that 25-footer from Jaws can't compare to you. You have this administration running for cover, the president and his little men all in a bitch snit. You are the man. I swear, never in my life.
Hal Brognola wondered why he felt like weeping. He was back in the spook van, staring at himself in the one-way glass. Something inside him had changed, though he wasn't sure what the metamorphosis was. He only knew he was different, somehow, forever. Hitting his reflection with a blast of smoke, he wasn't sure he liked what he saw. Older by a decade in the span of a few short but eternal days, haggard, soul all fragmented. He, like the Shadow Man, had seen the future, and it wasn't bright. But it was his duty, what he did, always had been, always would be, and tomorrow would thrust another Namek, more Tiger Ops in his face. He stared hard at his reflection, wondering who he really was. Husband? Father? Protector of national security? One more finger plugging a hole in the dike? The big Fed wasn't sure if he silently asked himself or the entity behind the glass the questions. He wondered if his soul wasn't right then flying towards his image.
You look exhausted, depressed perhaps. But I can understand, man of your position and power, secret as it might be. You want depressed? Allow me to tell you where it's all headed, my friend.
It was all Brognola could do to focus on the moment. How long since he'd seen his wife? Oh, but how badly he wanted, needed to return to the simple life of sanity with someone who knew him. Or did she really know him at all?
Near future worst case. A suitcase nuke is detonated in the heart of Washington. Congress and Senate in full session. President and all his important men under the White House. Bang. Poof. All gone. The entire seat of our government is wiped out. Anarchy sweeps the country. It's been stopped twice already, but there will be a third attempt. And who knows? Maybe this time they succeed. Could be more tiger ops out there in the bush, selling out, smuggling in the suitcase from Allah, setting the table for the enemy, skipping off to Tahiti later with numbered accounts.
Brognola was too damn tired for doomsday prattle. All he wanted was a double whiskey or two, alone. Listen to some music, alone, alone.
Your message said you might have something for me.
Indeed. My man will give you the package when you leave. First, house is in the process of being cleaned. Pentagon, DOD, the State Department, the NSA.
Trying to tell me the jackals who thought they were safe are in the process of being executed?
A crude way of stating the truth, but yes, they are being systematically eliminated.
And the Eagle Nebula?
It will be cleaned likewise. Relocated, restructured, reclassified. Too much cutting-edge work was going on there. We can't afford to just drop all the projects they were working on. As for Ezekiel Jacobs, I heard the Justice Department will be getting a visit soon.
Someone will show up at my office, you mean? Make me and him an offer we can't refuse?
More or less. Jacobs will get immunity and a deal. Sort of.
Spell that out, if you don't mind.
He'll spend the rest of his life under house arrest.
While he jumps through hoops for the government and goes on creating the future of warfare.
Something along those lines.
The entity was pretty typical of a Washington intelligence insider, Brognola thought. Talking, but not saying much. Evasive. Double-tongued. Always leaving an escape hatch open.
The Russians aren't happy, I understand, about losing Lightning Bat, but I would surmise they kept enough blueprints to build another. Only our side retrieved all of their divine alloy.
Small price to keep world peace.
The Cold War never ended, my friend.
Tell me something I don't already know.
If only I were in that position.
Are we finished?
For now, yes. Again, congratulations.
One of the entity's men opened the door on cue. Brognola stepped out and held his ground for a long moment, wondering. Another battle he knew was won, for the moment at least. As for tomorrow, God only knew what tomorrow would bring. More critical mass building somewhere in the country, on the planet, he was sure. But he would be there, ready to go the distance, perform his duty. It was who he was. It was all he knew.
Stony Man Doomsday Conquest is a Graphic Audio production. Stony Man, The Executioner, and Mac Bolan are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2005, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Christopher Graybill, Jeff Baker, David Coyne, Christopher Walker, Casey Jones, and Kate Torrey. Directed by Terence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Greg Reinfeld, Nathan DeBoard, and Kyle Univer. Graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, and Brian Rogers. The Stony Man theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Chris Rowan, Matt Webb, and Nathaniel Perry. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Lothar Holtz, and you have just been privileged to witness the premier non-laboratory test of Plattdeutsche Amerika's dynamic interface system.
No, that can't be true. This is amazing.
What is?
You see that man in the gray? We downloaded his thought patterns into our system along with the others in the bank. If I didn't see him with my own eyes, I would swear the patterns were a computer construct. This man interfaces with the computer better than any human I've ever seen. He's remarkable.
Has the super-secret crime-fighting government organization known as CURE been betrayed to its enemies?
May I have a seat?
Yes.
I'm certain you're wondering why I'm here.
The thoughts have crossed my mind.
I know of Shinanju.
Can a house divided still stand?
Remo is not himself. He is being manipulated.
Do not be a fool, Smith. Remo, step aside. Remo!
Chun! Remo is under some kind of mind control. His actions are not his own.
Has Master Chun's past finally caught up to him with fatal consequences?
You've amassed a Van Berlinfeld? You murdered Sir Chancellor.
If you refer to the strutting little fool with the comical mustache, he ingested poison and shot himself when he heard the master was coming.
Liar! You are a murderer, and you will stand and watch, filthy Korean mongrel. You will watch while I wrap my hands around your own lying throat and squeeze the life from you.
An old evil wears a new face in Destroyer number 112, Brainstorm. Buy it now from Graphic Audio.
Remember, you live at my convenience, Korean.
You die at mine.
If you can't find that hot Graphic Audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.